Okay, we have a very, very shy and reserved and introverted AA coming up here. Her name is Jeannie.
Jeannie!
I really am shy and introverted. Anyway, my name is Jimmy, and I take what you give me. Oh, wait a minute, that's the old Jeannie in a bottle. That's what I used.
She's doing.
No, my name is Jeannie, and I'm an alcoholic and an addict.
Hi, Jeannie.
Hi, Jeannie.
I haven't had a drink or a drug since June 12th of 2005. And that's where it starts. That's where it starts. My freedom. It's funny how God put Sandy before me because, like, she was the cheerleader, you know, rooting for the team, and I was under the bleachers smoking pot and drinking while she was, you know, rah-rah and doing everything right, and I was like blatantly like, anyway, oh my gosh. I am Jimmy and I take what you give me. That's what I became when I started my career in drinking. It was like, feed me, feed me, feed me. I'll take what you can give me. I don't care what I have to do, where I have to go. That's all I cared about. But I want to go back to a little bit of where I came from. I'm from Cleveland, Ohio. I don't know if there's any Clevelanders out there, but I still love Cleveland. It's in my heart and in my story. And I'm the eldest of five girls. I came from an Ozzie and Harriet family. You know, my mother didn't wear an apron and high heels to vacuum, but she was always in a tennis skirt with her, you know, at the club playing tennis, and my father was an engineer, very successful. So the environment wasn't, you know, the reason why I'm an alcoholic. I was born with this disease. And I was churched in Catholicism, which I'm grateful today that God must have known what kind of life I was going to live, so he put me with Marie and Albert, who were Catholic, who immediately baptized me, and it was like, okay, she's okay. No matter where she goes or what she does, she's mine. So I went to parochial schools for the first 9 years of my life, and that was part of, I think, my problem with my self-esteem, because school was a struggle. I only was schooled for 12 years, and that was enough for me. I struggled from the very beginning. I was always in group C when the smart people were in group A, and it wasn't a good fit for me. And I have compassion for kids today that, you know, are in the special ed classes or have ADD or, you know, I mean, it's just not that box that everybody fits into, and I definitely didn't fit into it. And the only other thing that I, you know, looking back, I was always tiny, short in the front row. I had a little pixie haircut. That felt different too. And I also was sexually abused in the third grade, which I think opened up a door that should have never been opened for a young little girl. And I have compassion for people who have suffered from that kind of thing as well. So when I was 15 years old, it was the first time I ever had alcohol, and I know you alcoholics out there can relate to this. You wait in front of the store, you beg somebody who looks somewhat cool to buy you the Boone's Farm, in my case it was Ripple, and stood behind in the alley and drank that, and I'm telling you, and a lot of all alcoholics can relate, that beautiful feeling of nirvana, like I have died and gone to heaven, all is well with my soul, came over me, and then I got arrested for public intoxication at 15 years old, the first time I ever drank. Sign of things to come, my wonderful father, my blessed father, came and bailed me out, and that was the beginning of 16 years of my fantasy, sex, drugs, rock and roll, you know, the whole deal. But it was also the beginning of me being promiscuous, me lying, me cheating, stealing, manipulating. I wasn't being really the true Jeannie that God created me to be. So from the age of 15 until I got sober, I pretty much every day revolves around drinking and drugging. And even though you might not have noticed that, that's what I woke up every day. And in high school, it was every weekend. As I became older and more responsible, it was like, how am I going to do this and look normal in everyday life? Just after graduating from high school, I met the man of my dreams. He was a mixture between the Fonz, Keith Richards, Mick Jagger, and Warren Beatty. He was the man for me. And he liked to party. He also had connections to all the good stuff. And we immediately moved to Los Angeles, California, which was another part of the dream, you know, as a Cleveland girl wanting to live at the beach. And we lived there for 12 years. It was life in the fast lane for me. While I was there, I have my one moment and claim to fame, and just for your entertainment, I'll share it with you, is working for Larry Flint Distributing and Publishing Company. I was a very respectable young lady who worked in the distributing department, distributing pornography all over the United States and the world. And that was a great fit for me because everybody there partied. Larry and his wife were, you know, drug addicted, crazy people. And he would roll around in his 14 karat gold wheelchair with, you know, his eyes were all out there. And it didn't matter if you were hungover because he didn't know. But anyway, he got arrested. And so my claim to fame is when he got arrested for the fighting for his Fifth Amendment rights and they put him in jail, he handpicked a bunch of people, cute women, to put on short skirts and high heels and walk around the outside of the courthouse carrying signs that said, "Let Larry loose, let Larry loose." And, so I got paid to do that, and it's in the movie. And and he had strong guys that carrying down his bail in pennies. He paid it in all pennies. So anyway, you know, that was the funny story, that, you know, but it really wasn't too funny. I was under my desk a lot and in a lot of trouble there. And yeah, I mean, during that time, you know, the man of my dreams, we were getting drugs delivered from, you know, Detroit and Cleveland by FedEx. And one day FedEx came a week late to the door with all the drugs I was waiting for. Quaaludes were, that was the day of Quaaludes, alcohol and Quaaludes. And they delivered the drug, the 500 pills, and I was like, yes! I had to go out to go to a doctor's appointment, and on my way to the doctor, the car in front of me stops, the car behind me stops, the car on the right stops, and I'm like, what? You know, get out of my way, I got an appointment. Next thing I know, they're like escorting me out of my car, handcuffing me, telling me, you know, I said, what's this all about? Well, we just delivered drugs. Oh, really? You did? And what's going to happen? So they held me while they broke into the house with the flak vest, the guns, and, you know, my husband was on his, or he was my boyfriend, and on his face, on the floor, we were both handcuffed. It should have been a wake-up call, but it really wasn't. It was like, oh, man, what's going to happen with all those Quaaludes, you know? I mean, actually, they were evidence, and actually his lawyer stuck his hand over the bench and got a handful of them and gave them to the man of my dreams while he was in court. That we got God's grace. I don't think it was God's grace. It was just a fluke that the federal people issued a warrant before they delivered the drugs, and the judge had to throw it out. So I didn't have to suffer a consequence there. Anyway, that was kind of life in California, and things started getting really bad after we decided to get married. And at that time we lived at the beach, and you know, it's like the beach, it seems like then I always had my blinds closed because I was not only drinking, and now there were no more Quaaludes, so I was using Xanax and I was smoking cocaine all the time. My life revolved around the party, and really I had, it's like a dead man walking, I call it, because I had no other dreams or desires or goals, and I used you and I sought you out only if you were in that world. After we got married, you know, there was public intoxications. You know, I spent time in jail screaming and hollering. They still wouldn't let me out. You know, I demanded that they let me out, and if they didn't, I was going to make their life miserable, and I certainly did. But, you know, I was found on the beach face down, you know, with my bathing suit falling off and thrown into jail for public intoxication a couple times. And one time the cops actually said to my significant other, let us do you a favor and put her in jail for the night, you know, and that's where I ended up. But I got pregnant, and we decided that we were going to have this child. And that was where I realized for the very first time that I was totally powerless, because choosing to give life to a child and not being able to stop using was a wake-up call for me. I couldn't stop. I was powerless. So I would go 2 days, 3 days, all excited, we're going to have a baby, and then I'd drink. And then it was like, oh my God, I can't have this child. And this went on for 3 months until I made a geographical and moved back to Cleveland, where I hung out with my family, stayed sober, and gave birth to my son, who was born in 1987. And then 3 years after that, in 1990, I was able to stay sober through this pregnancy and had a daughter. So after their birth, I was, you know, kind of the normal mom trying to be normal. You know, I'd do everything mommy-wise before, you know, 1 or 2 o'clock, and then, you know, I'd start drinking. And things, you know, got bad again. I was married. I would pick fights with my husband when he'd roll in from work. I was, you know, the shut-off valve wasn't there, guys. This alcoholic does not have a shut-off valve. From the very beginning, once it was opened with drugs or alcohol, it doesn't close, and I'm on. I'm gone, and you can count on that. So that's what I would do, and I'd pick a fight. I'd go out and roam around the neighborhood. I lived in Hermosa Beach. I could walk everywhere I wanted to go. Lots of people drank and partied, and that's what I would do until something happened. And I discovered in writing my story again that my husband went to an Al-Anon meeting. And, you know, that saved my life, because he came home and he said, I'm done. I'm not putting up with this anymore. I'm drawing the line. I'm taking the kids, and I'm kicking you out if you don't get some help. And I was really wasted at the time that he told me that, but I did have enough semblance to call the AA hotline, and they sent a really cool chick from the Hermosa Club down to my house. She came in, picked me up, took me to a meeting. I was drunk. But right then and there, I thought, well, you know, I'd rather do this than lose my children and be kicked out on the street. So I began to use her as my sponsor. I started working the steps. I went to her house. We read the big book. It was all very strange to me, very, very strange. I mean, I know how everybody feels a little strange coming in here. But, you know, the desperation that I had was enough to keep me coming back. And slowly things, you know, life did get better. It was much easier being a wife and a mother and a citizen when you weren't, you know, constantly under the influence. Anyway, so before I had a year sobriety, my husband moved me to Texas. OMG, I thought everybody was a redneck here with tumbleweed and trucks, and I did not want to come, but I'm glad I made it. And I came here to Club 12 because in California they know about this place. And they told me about this place. They also told me about Lambda, 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 but I didn't go check Lambda out. But Club 12, great sobriety in San Antonio. And this is the first place I came. And I went to the women's Monday night meeting, 7 o'clock in that room over there where you used to be able to smoke. And I hooked up with a lot of great women, and I got myself a sponsor named Linda, and I visited her once a week. We read the book, and she taught me about love and tolerance, and mostly about loving myself. I needed to learn to love myself then, and it was a really beautiful time. And at that time, my husband and I joined a church. Our kids were in good schools. We lived in a nice neighborhood. I mean, life was good, and I started doing a lot with my church. They were taking care of us in our marriage, giving us counseling, and we were getting healing and all the stuff that comes with that, okay? And life was really, really beautiful and good. Looking back, the thing that I can say is that I had a trigger, and the trigger was I had to have a medical procedure, and my doctor said, here's a Valium to help calm you down. And I should have known better, but I wasn't around here enough, you know, and I wasn't accountable to anybody really in this room. And I just said, great, and I took it, and that was that 15-year-old girl who took that first drink right there after 12 years, and I went, oh my God, I want more. I mean, I really did, but I kept myself together for a little bit longer. I wasn't hanging out in these rooms enough. I wasn't going to meetings. I wasn't really sponsoring anybody. And I talked myself into being a respectable, normal, Christian woman, a mother and a wife who could drink. And I picked up a drink, and as soon as I picked up the drink, this is a relapse, I knew it, and the obsession and the valve was opened, and I opened the can of whoop-ass. That's what it was, a can of whoop-ass. But I kept pretending that, you know, maybe I could possibly do this, and I knew immediately. But I tried that for 2 years, and I'm lucky that, you know, there were people that I was associated with that kept knocking at my door and ringing my phone. And, you know, because of them, I'm here today, but I don't want to jump ahead. I went 2 years where immediately it was like I was the prescriptions to the drugs again, Ambien, Xanax. I was smoking pot because my high school son was smoking pot, so I was smoking pot with him. Anything I could get my hands on, that's what I was doing. I hit in a drunken stupor. I tripped and broke my foot. This, you know, it wasn't cute anymore. You know, it just what isn't cute when you're in your 40s and you're tripping over stuff and breaking your feet and crawling up the stairs and your young children are watching you. And it was, you know, as a sober person, I can see how ugly that would be. So I had the pain pills, everything, and the people still knocking on the door. Come on, Jeannie, come back. And they're still loving me. As a matter of fact, I would come up here sometimes and read the big book. I can't remember his name. I loved him. He's gone to heaven now, but he is Raymond would read the big book, and he loved me and accepted me. I don't ever want to forget that. Chris E. came knocking on my door, trying to get me to go into rehab, and instead I got him to go to the corner store and get me some tall boys. I love pissing him off. I mean, but still, they were there, and they didn't walk away, and I'm really grateful for them. Anyway, I think my bottom and my wake-up call there was, and I would have died, okay? I'm saying that in one sentence, but it's a meaty statement. I would have been dead because my son came home one day. I was out, not breathing on the kitchen floor, totally blue after having ingested, not meaning to do any harm, but just, you know, catch a buzz, all those drugs that I told you about. And he woke me up, and it was like, okay, I'll go. So I embraced it. I got the blessing, and it's by God's grace that I made it into Starlight in June of 2005, and I got to forget everything I knew. I had to forget everything I knew, and I had to, and that's double humility, which, by the way, humility, guys, for me is the cloak of honor I wear today. It's the coolest leather jacket I could put on, okay? Humility is like my greatest badge, because I know that when I'm walking humbly, my God can work through me and with me and use me to give away what I've gotten in these rooms. So I try to practice humility. Like, even, you know, coming up here and preparing for this, I had a big resentment towards Don. Don came up to me while I'm standing with two of my sponsees and asks if we want to, you know, do this Sunday. Of course I don't want to do this, you know? And they're standing there going, yes, they're like bright in recovery. And I'm like, oh, Don, I'm going to kill you. And he was like on my resentment list. And, you know, the humility of waking up Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, like, okay, give me a message, God. What's the message, God? I got nothing all week long. And, you know, and I had to humble myself and remember how simple this program is. This is a simple program, and if I show up, if I work the steps, if I go to meetings, and if, you know, like, my favorite step today is step 10, continue to, well, one of my favorites, continue to take personal inventory, and when I'm wrong, I promptly admit it. I don't go to bed angry. I get to take an inventory every night. Step 11 is sought through prayer and meditation. You know, I had to rely on prayer and meditation. God, your will, not my will, be done. And step 12, carrying that message to other people. I mean, like, just being up here, I'm part of your story now, you're part of mine. We're in this together. I'm not alone. I'm never going to walk away from AA. That was my art. This was the art that took me to the freedom that I have today, to be the truest, best genie that I could be, you know. And I'm not any longer Jimmy, and I'll take what you give me. I'm not that genie in the bottle. I'm like, well, what is my name today? I don't know. I'll think of one, but I'm just grateful. You know, I'm humble, I'm grateful. I'm teachable. You know, today I see the possibility in everything. I'm going to be 60 in about a month, and it's like I'm sitting at that age where you're like Chris was talking about last Sunday, like kind of like, yeah, it's all cool, it's all cool, it's all love, you know, trying to be that loving instrument. And, you know, I'm grateful. I want to share something, end it with the family afterward, because yes, this is a family disease, and it has affected my family. My son is serving prison time for, and this is a huge sentence that carries a lot of weight, he's in prison for intoxication manslaughter. I got to be sober through that whole thing, and, you know, that's an ongoing work in progress. And my daughter has been introduced to these rooms. I wonder if she's an addict. See that sick thinking? I'm still going, I wonder if she's really an addict. She's been in rehab 3 times. You think she's an addict? What the F? I need to go to Al-Anon, and I am in Al-Anon right now, by the way, working the steps. But I know. Anyway, so I want to read something that spoke to me. God gave it to me today. He didn't give it to me Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, or Friday, but he gave it to me actually yesterday, and it's in page 124 of our big book, and it's what Henry Ford made that wise remark to the effect that experience is the thing of supreme value in life. That is true only if one is willing to turn the past to good account. We grow by our willingness to face and rectify errors and convert them into assets. The alcoholic's past thus becomes the principal asset of the family, and frequently it is almost the only one. And so that's what I'm doing. I'm a living amends to my friends and my family, and I do it by showing up. And I'm very grateful. I just want to give a shout out to Haven Nation, Haven for Hope, Alpha House. You know, those are places that are putting out these brilliant, I'm telling you, I think recovery that's coming up, at least the way I'm seeing it, you guys are brilliant. And I encourage you to keep coming back and share what you're learning with us, because you keep me sober and refreshed and renewed. And rejoice, that's my new favorite word. Let's all rejoice and thank God.
Hey, Judy.